All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the No Film School podcast for the week of July 15th, 2022. I'm here with cinematographer Todd Blankenship.
Hey, how's it going?
Filmmaker Grace Hawkins.
Hello. Oh, you're using my birth name.
Well, y'all, it's always lost in Graceland at the end, so I figured yes, I would help people orient. But we can go. Gigi is.
Grace. The second G is Gloria, named after two grandmas. So now everyone knows.
I mean, that is a religious name, Grace and Gloria.
I know,
like,
right?
You are destined to lead the battle into France. And I'm here with Editor-in-Chief George Edelman of No Film School.
Hello.
And I'm filmmaker Charles Hayne. And this week we're going to be talking about Taika Waititi's idea that director's cuts are stupid, which might just be clickbait, but I'm fine with it. We're going to be talking about working conditions for the VFX teams in Marvel movies. We're going to be talking about a possible replacement for VFX work, Todd Blankenship's adventures in the AI machine learning DALL-E space. And we're going to be talking about viral shorts turning into features, all that, and maybe a little more this week on the No Film School podcast. So, our first story, directors have this obligation, and it's probably contractual, that when they have a movie coming out, they have to say some controversial shit to try and get clicks. We see it with Scorsese saying all Marvel movies are dumb when The Irishman was coming out. We see it last week with James Cameron saying, I don't care if you piss your pants about Avatar 3. And this week, Taika Waititi joins the fray, and he has Thor, The Underworld, Dark World, Love and Thunder. It's Thor Love and Thunder coming out.
Thor 4?
I was going to say Thor 4.
Thor 4. And he wanted to let everyone know that he thinks director's cuts are dumb. And, you know, I continue to think that people say, like, trolling is a thing we do on the internet. You know, when I was accusing the old man and Up of being a NIMBY, like, I was deliberately saying some stuff on Twitter to try and get into arguments with people. And then I got into arguments with people, and it was super fun. I'm going to guess that in real life, there's probably some director's cuts that Taika Waititi really likes. But, you know, the take he's taking, which I think is a fair take, is if you have enough directorial power, you should keep fighting to make the movie everything you want it to be for its initial theatrical run, which, like, for real, is the time the vast majority of people will see it in the theater. Mm-hmm. And that's where you should fight as hard as you can for your vision to play out. And, you know, giving up on that and being like, oh, well, I'll always be able to release my real director's cut later is a little bit of like quitterdom, which I agree with. On the flip side, there's lots of really wonderful people who got removed from projects for bullshit reasons. Touch of Evil with Orson Welles being the great example of, like, you know, Orson Welles, probably more interesting a filmmaker than the studio executive at Universal in the 50s who took the film from him. And they chopped up the opening and they made a mess of it. And he left behind that memo of, like, here's what would fix it. And then 20 years ago, Walter Murch worked with a team of people to try and make Touch of Evil, the director's cut, as close to what Orson would have wanted. And, like, that movie rocks. I'm not going to say that that isn't better. So I think there's cases where, like, for whatever reason, for personality reasons, for fish stick reasons, people get removed from projects. And I would like to be able to later see their version of it.
I think, you know, if you are at the level that he's at, then actually, I just totally agree with him in terms of most people in the world, unless you are truly, you know, have gotten your reps in and have made multiple features and you have proven that you can tell a great cinematic story. But, like, thinking of, you know, the No Film School audience and myself as, like, an early emerging filmmaker, I think the best thing you can do as a director is let the editor fire you and let them make something, bring their fresh perspective to whatever you filmed and make the best cut ever. So, but I just don't see that happening as much, like, emerging directors putting trust in the editors. So that's my take at the sort of, like, indie short film sketch scale.
I actually like that. And I want to add to it. I think he's really talking about the Snyder cut type deal where, mm-hmm. you know, and I don't want to go into that whole thing. We have a lot of posts on it on nofilmschool.com if you're into reading about what was what and why and all of that. But I think sometimes, like, it's just limitations are where a lot of great creativity is born. And for every example Charles points out where there's Orson Welles, who's a genius and who's pulled off something for various reasons, for fish stick reasons. And then he comes back and, or he has ideas and notes, and then somebody like Walter Murch implements them, and that's beautiful. By the way, I interviewed Walter Murch once on this podcast and he talked about that. Cool. So find that episode. It's awesome. But either way, there are also incidents where it's like, you know what? It probably should have been shorter and it's fine, and let's live with the end collaborated product, because most of the time, or 99.9% of the time, film is such a collaborative medium and a process of limitations. And I always cite another classic movie like Casablanca, where there's multiple cooks in the kitchen at all times and nobody was really in charge for much of it. Like, in the sense that, and it's just this beautiful, happy accident in certain ways that, like, everything mm-hmm. about it is so great. But then there's also like Ridley Scott and Blade Runner. So there's so many variations on this, but I like your point, Gigi, that more we should try to raise a generation of filmmakers that's thinking more like, I need people to cut me, and less that are thinking like, director's cut. You know, I want to be that kind of director. It's just better for the learning and for the medium and for the collaboration and for everything to think that way, instead of to assume you have all the answers always and your version's the best version. But I also think he's kind of bemoaning a little bit, maybe. I mean, clickbait, yes, for sure. But also that fan culture is so obsessed with the release, the blank cut. And in some cases, that's totally a meme and that's cool and funny. But in other cases, it's like, no, we don't really want to encourage this, like a re-release of every movie that's longer and just has a bunch of extra scenes that nobody needs. And that, you know, just like, we don't need that. Like, nobody needs that.
Well, there's the great example. As far as I can tell, the Coen brothers have only released one director's cut, which is Blood Simple, and it's 4 minutes shorter. And they said in interviews, they were like, yeah, I mean, we had director's cut on Blood Simple. It was a little indie. There's no studio. But then we looked at it 30 years later and we were like, you know, we could tighten this up a little bit. Like, we know more now than we used to. And they took 4 minutes out for the release. I didn't release. Know
that. That's awesome. Yeah, I mean, I think there's a huge difference between a director's cut that's like, you know, 2 hours longer than the theatrical version that was initially released. And, I mean, you know, the Touch of Evil example is a really good one. I also think of Terry Gilliam's Brazil. They pushed really hard to have it end on this really lame, happy note. And I think there was an actual theatrical release of that version. And then eventually they came out with the real one, which is like kind of one of my favorite endings of all time. So, you know, it's, there's a big difference between the two things, I think. Like, yeah, the Snyder cut is one thing. That's a really good
point too. And you know, I always loved deleted scenes. I was a big fan of DVD special features and I loved seeing all the things. I love that when that Boogie Nights DVD came out, I got to see extra scenes. I know they don't make sense to add to a long movie and for flow and whatever, but I just loved that he put together a bunch of extra takes of like John C. Reilly doing cocaine, which is amazing to watch just because it's fun. Like, so I think there's a place and a way to involve the extra stuff that was shot that you enjoyed but didn't make it in. So
yeah, the master also had a really, really amazing like unused footage reel that was like hypnotically fun to watch. So yeah, it's all, to me, it's like, you know, I will never bemoan someone who's like squeezing more that the last drop of something out of a project that they made a long time ago. And they're like, hey, you know, maybe you want to watch this again. I found this other way to cut it. Mm-hmm. That's, to me, that's different than like, I don't know, just, I think I'm just kind of stuck on the Snyder cut issue.
Well, I'm going to introduce something that pivots us to our next story, which is, I think that the concept of like a release cut and a director's cut is, or like unreleased footage or deleted scenes, is radically different in the CGI era. And all the examples we're talking about of like, oh, well, this is great, they cut 4 minutes out of Blood Simple, or like they reconstructed Touch of Evil or whatever, are all without CGI. And it's interesting because Taika Waititi talked a lot in interviews around Thor 3 where he was like, you know, I was a little indie filmmaker who was very used to like, I'm working a thing. And I never wanted to be one of those filmmakers who was like driving to the Valley every day in Los Angeles, like for a year of post on a movie. And then all of a sudden I found myself 6 months into a year of driving to the Valley every day to do post on a movie. And he said the weirdest thing about post on Thor 3 was how infinite the choices continued to be. Because on a normal movie, you have to make a bunch of choices on set, and then you have to live with those choices in post. So you're always like, shit, why didn't I get a close-up? Or like, why didn't I shoot it this way? Or like, I wish we'd fit that scene in. Whereas on Thor 3, he was like, every set we ever went to, they scanned the whole thing. And so if I was sitting in post and I was like, could we tilt down? Even if we hadn't tilted down on set, they were always like, sure. And then they just add a tilt down in post. Or like, they just make a close-up happen. Or like this infinite realm of possibility occurred. And I think, honestly, within the context of digital post-production, director's cuts are dumb because the palette becomes so infinite and so unlimited. You need some boundary. And frankly, the boundary of a studio and a release date helping you focus your time and your decisions within the infinite canvas, I think is probably incredibly helpful. And when I think about a lot of the self-indulgent director's cuts, like Lucas redoing the Star Wars movies with cheesy effects in the 90s and a bunch of other like, you know, the Snyder Cut, which is a heavy CGI production, I think there it's an infinite canvas problem where without boundaries, you're just like so free to sprawl that it could go on forever and ever and ever. And I think that's radically different than a filmmaker like PT, who like still shoots film, still doesn't really do digital effects. I think still finishes photochemically, if I remember correctly. I know the Master finished photochemically. I think Inherent Vice finished photochemically. I think they might have finally broken and did a digital finish on Licorice Pizza, but I need to double check that. It might still be. So it's like, you know, he doesn't have an infinite palette. He has the whatever hours of footage they shot, and he can monkey with that forever, and then he has to be done.
Did we talk about this on the podcast, or did I talk about it with a friend, how PTA spends like a week shooting, then takes a week off and like reconfigures things and then shoots it again? Which in a way is
I haven't heard of that, but that's...
I've never heard of that.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense to me. It kind of makes me think of when they made Boyhood. Like, I've always wondered like how that must have been to like go shoot, you know, for that year of the movie and then come home and have like a whole year to kind of think about what to do next, you know, doing a much shorter version of that with a week in between. That's pretty cool.
I mean, I think all the time, I'm obsessed with like different ways of doing production because I'm not convinced that we do it right. I'm convinced we do it a way we figured out in the 30s with like specific technology and there's new ways to do it. And like the famous example of that is the Paul Greengrass Bourne movies, is because Matt Damon was the only big star and because he was on board for Greengrass's way of doing it, it was either Ultimatum or the third one that they famously shot the entire thing three times. Like they went to all the locations all over the world, and then they took a month off and edited, and then they went to all the locations all over the world, and then took a month off to edit, and then they went back to all the locations all over the world. It's the big example that I've always heard of like thinking about movies in a different way. And going back to like thinking about Licorice, like I suspect that he was able to do that on Licorice Pizza and on Phantom Thread because of close collaborations with the celebrity involved. The Phantom Thread, they were shooting in Daniel Day-Lewis's hometown. In Licorice Pizza, everyone lives in LA. But I suspect that that's something that he's only been able to do lately. Like, I can't imagine The Master shooting in San Francisco where no one lives with Philip Seymour Hoffman, who was like a huge star at the time. The luxury of that time was probably not available to him.
I feel like he just has the most latitude in the most amazing like film nerd fantasy way of anyone. Because he really is just like musing on celluloid as much as long. And I know like I've talked to the people he worked with and they talk about how they always have limitations. And I know that their limitations are real, but it's like they also talk about how he can pull any print of any movie from the studios and they send it to him and he has like his home projector set up and they just watch all these movies. And when I heard that, sort of was like, does working on a Paul Thomas Anderson film is just like the film person's fantasy come true? Like they're just playing, you know, in that endless sandbox, and it's amazing. And yeah, this story just adds to like they get rushes. Like they watch they watch what they shot get they see it printed and they watch it. Like how cool is that? He's the only person in the world I mean, maybe Tarantino does stuff like that.
There's this short that I saw recently, and it played at Berlin, and it's called Filipiniana. And I was chatting with the director who shot it in the Philippines at a golf course over the course of 5 weeks. This is a 20-minute short, but the sort of PTA approach that they took was they could only shoot on Sundays because that was the only time the golf course was doing maintenance. So over the course of like 5 weeks, the team was like planning these. They had so much prep in between that the shots ended up coming out with like such incredible composition, and they were like editing in between. And I was like, oh, this is like interesting slow burn filmmaking at the indie shorts level. And it was, you know, to Charles's point about like, are we doing it right? Or what other ways can we tell great stories? I was so inspired to hear like how that short came to be and the sort of slow process.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Have you ever wondered what it's like to bite into Nerds gummy clusters? They're fruity. They're tangy. They're gummy. And they're crunchy. Nerds gummy clusters, a union of fruity sweet gummy and tangy crunchy nerds. Unleash your senses. Shop now at nerdscandy.com.
Yeah, the power of VFX too. Like what Charles was saying, we've talked about it before. There's such an amazing way it can be used to augment things and enhance and create experiences for people. But it can also make very lazy decisions possible, like sequences that are not planned and shot and then rearranged entirely in a VFX edit, which is extremely expensive and time consuming, but doable. And it gives that power to change things in a way that isn't organic. And I don't want to sound like old and crusty about it, but like, I do feel like the Star Wars prequels were like, they opened up this Pandora's box of problems. Like they were, I remember in those special features they showed the first time I saw anybody do this, they were like splicing multiple takes from different cuts seamlessly. And it was just like this weird, like, is that why this whole thing is so robotic and disconnected, is because like people are playing scenes to different takes for the other half of the frame. Like everything feels so disjointed and inhuman. And like, it's not just about special effects. It's about it allowing you to rearrange every like cell that you created into a body that doesn't work.
I think it's so, it's so much about, you know, that sort of give and take between, you know, working within your limitations and having limitations. And it's kind of that. And then it's also this sort of thing where like taking your time is important when you're on set. And like that for me was a big lesson. And I think VFX kind of lends this whole world where like you can sort of make quick decisions. And you know, the old joke is, you know, we'll fix it in post thing. Like, That whole mentality is such a thing, but it's like, I'll put it this way. Like, I remember very early on in my career, I was doing a lot of one man band stuff, and just like, you know, everything I ever shot was just like, I wasn't putting any thought into anything. And I was just running around shooting, whatever, you know, just coverage, you know, content coverage. And I was trying to make it look as good as I could, but I'd always notice like, man, like there's other people whose stuff is just better. Why is it so much better? Why are they able to pull these things off? And then I got to AC under this guy. He's kind of the big shot in town in Dallas. And we were doing a doc project, and most of what I was doing was doc projects. And we had like 30 to 45 minutes just to get one shot of B-roll. And we would light it and really make methodical decisions about like what it was doing. And it was a completely different world to me. And it changed everything from my perspective. And then to me, it's like, it's that sort of thing where it's like, okay, like what we get in the can is what we're going to use, but we're going to take our time doing it. And so I, you know, I'm real heavy into the VFX world. And that's been a thing that's really kind of like, I have it now where like I can shoot a scene, take a 3D scan of the scene with my phone, and then you reproject the actual shot from your camera onto geometry that you created with your phone. And then you can create a second camera in virtual space and reframe the shot. And it looks fine. And it's insane. And it's the weirdest thing in the world, because you can go, like, if you wanted to, you could have like anything in the world happen. You could have your camera just flying around a scene that you just shot with a tripod shot. And I mean, you can't, there's points where it breaks. There's points where, like, obviously, like, you start to see the side of the cabinet and the cabinet is stretched really weird looking, but it's like, you know, it's cool. It's really cool. But that freedom is so daunting. That freedom is like, I could totally screw up my story.
Yeah. Well, let's pivot from that to talking about our next subject. What happens with all that freedom?
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's 3 a.m. and I'm trying to work on this shot and I'm getting tired. And then, you know, it's like, who, like,
go ahead. And that's you alone. So our second story this week sort of builds off that, which is Marvel Studios. There's been a big article in Slash Film about workers on VFX projects for Marvel sort of all getting very public with it being a really unpleasant working experience. And it's becoming sort of a publicly known bad place to work in VFX. So I just, before we go too far, I just want to say, every time we talk about this with VFX, people are always like, yeah, but I heard this one VFX artist was making like $1,000 a day, so I don't want to hear them complain. And it's like, first off, not everybody makes great rates in VFX. There's many different rates at many different levels. Secondly, I want people to be able to make $1,000 a day because they're really good at something, but work reasonable hours and still see their kids. And yes, even a senior artist who might be out there making $1,000 a day should still be able to like pick their kid up at school or be home for dinner or like not be waking up with anxiety at 4 a.m. in order to start working again on something because of the deadline. And I think one of the reasons why we're seeing so much of this specifically at Marvel is, you know, it is a studio that's doing a tremendous volume of work, but there's also a lot of cooks in the kitchen. And when you have executives from Disney and executives from Marvel and executives from, you know, the director, there can be a lot of, you know, Marvel is notorious for continuing to do a variety of iterations very late in the process, which means you're doing a tremendous amount of VFX work, 90% of which is thrown out, which is like such a waste of human effort.
To me, so much of a Marvel movie at this point feels like white noise, because I just sense it's this wall of VFX. Like, it just feels so over fiddled with and graphiced. And even when I kind of like what's happening, I still just feel, and I know these movies are immensely popular, and, you know, this is totally an opinion and it means nothing in the grand scheme of the world, but to me, there's just so much going on. I even find the trailers, like, this is my old man rancid cloud, I guess, but like, I even find the trailers like, oh my God, like, Sometimes less is more by such a large degree. You can actually make an explosion or a moment or a cool looking design feature pop when there's one of them and not just a constant gluttony. And I'm not telling these people how to run their business, because they're doing a great job.
So hey Marvel, I got a few pointers for
right,
you.
Okay? Yeah. No, I know they have more money than I do. They're better at this. Like, I admit it. I could not do what they do on any level, but I still look at it as a student of the craft and a person who just talks to and listens to and, you know, absorbs this stuff forever. And I look at it as like, I feel like you could be more compelling. I feel like you could be more effective with your bullets. Like, I feel like you don't need to throw it all at the wall like that. And, you know, when I hear things like this story to me, it's like, well, it kind of makes sense. Like, it just seems like so overwrought. And how could you possibly do it without working people to the bone because it's so much work to create those. They are amazing visuals. Like, it is amazing, but it's just so much work. Again, I'll go back to, because for me, this was like a big learning. Like, when I first looked at those special features on those Star Wars prequels, I was learning a lot about what VFX were going to become. I think we all were, because it was a new era, really. And I remember just thinking, holy shit, there's a lot of people doing stuff. Like, there's a guy whose job is just like Yoda's eyebrow. You know, and I mean, that's like a joke version of it, but there is so much and so many people who have to work so hard. And so I'm not surprised at all that it's like this. And I don't think it's to anyone's benefit, but, you know, I guess maybe to the conglomerate, because there's a sense that, like, if you don't keep doing more and more, if you take a step back, there's going to be some level of disappointment. So I think it does have to keep being bigger, bigger, more, more, more. But that paints you into a corner, in my opinion. So those are my business tips for Marvel and Disney.
The truth of the matter, as someone who's like run a post house and is now desperately trying to figure out how to have an ethical industry, is that like those hours get worked out of a fantasy of how much you're going to be able to accomplish. And that leads to underhiring and underscheduling. And like, you know, the last two projects I've done, we shot 8-hour days. And like, we needed more people to do 8-hour days, and we got less done in 8-hour days. So we needed more days because we were shooting 8-hour days. And that's just the part of life. And so like, there's a certain amount to which like the entire film industry suffers from this delusion of like, well, we'll just put people through crunch and we'll make it. And it's like, well, why don't you just hire twice as many people? Like, it will cost you twice as much. But at a certain point, like, then all of those people will go home at night.
Well, as opposed to being there until 4 in the morning. 100 times better too. I think one thing that's really, to me, like, I get so pissed anytime I see this kind of stuff. There's a couple examples that pop immediately to my mind, but like recently that She-Hulk trailer that came out. I almost want to assume that this has like that tweet might have been related to people probably working on that show, because when that came out, it was just like immediate, just, you know, downpour of just like, these are the worst VFX ever. Why does she look so terrible? All this sort of stuff. And I know the actress involved, she was kind of like, I think she had a lot of stuff coming at her about it. It was just like a very unfortunate thing. And it's just like, no, I mean, these people are making a television show with really, really, really difficult to do VFX in every single scene. And you have, it's like, one thing that you really need to look at is whenever you see bad VFX, it's not because the people doing them are bad at VFX. These are people at the top of the industry. They're working for Marvel, for God's sake. Like, they're not bad at what they do. So clearly, if something bad is happening, it has nothing to do with their skill level. It has everything to do with the amount of time that they had and the amount of resources that they had to do it. And so many of these people are not getting paid a lot. Like,
they probably worked really hard to deliver what they did deliver. And that's the tragedy. I agree. I think you're making a really good point. It's about who's allocating resources. That's who you look at.
Yeah. Well, and it's just, I mean, like, imagine you're just completely grinding. You're grinding for months on end, making, you know, let's say like entry level to slightly higher salary. If you're really working at a good post house. And then your trailer finally drops and everyone on the planet is shitting on it. And you've just worked your fingers to the bone and had people, you know, breathing over your neck all day long. And that's the thing, is it's just like, you know, I fully agree with everything George said about VFX and how the way that they're used is just, it's just too much. There's just too much going on and there's not enough grounded in reality or whatever. But it's like, when you see bad VFX, it's not, generally speaking, it's not because the people doing them were unskilled. It's something else.
Well, one of the things that I think about a lot is, I remember really early in my career, I think I might have still been in film school. I heard, like, I saw some movie and the ADR was terrible. And I was like, I'm just never going to use ADR. Like, ADR is just a bad thing. That's auto dialogue replacement. That's like dubbing dialogue in post. And I remember mentioning something about that to one of my sound teachers. And I said what the movie was, and it was like a huge budget movie that I'd seen in the theater. It was Entrapment with Catherine Zeta-Jones and Sean Connery, which is like one of the biggest movies of the year. Not a great movie, but terrible ADR. And I mentioned it to my sound design teacher, and my sound design teacher was like, the biggest movies are all way too rushed in post, and it's where all the shittiest post work is done. So if you're judging whether or not you think ADR can work based on a huge budget movie, you're making a mistake, because often big budget movies are so slammed in the tail end of post that they have like sub student film work. And then that sound teacher showed me some like mid-budget movies where they'd had reasonable post schedules, or like A-list directors where they'd had time, where he's like, oh, hey, look at this scene that I worked on from, I'm going to say Scorsese, because I know he always has a lot of time in post. It wasn't a Scorsese film, but it was another like A-list film, but like smaller budget. And I was like, that's ADR. And he's like, yep, that's ADR. You can't tell, can you? When you have time to do it, you can make it good. But on the biggest budget movies, like, there's so many cooks in the kitchen. There's a release date you're trying to make. The picture is constantly changing its edit because nobody's committed to picture lock. And then by the time picture lock finally happens, all of these highly trained professionals are doing work that they're frankly embarrassed by, because they're trying to get through however many ADR lines they have to fix or however many VFX shots they have to do under this insane time frame. And frankly, it ends up leading a lot of people away from features. I remember when I was working more heavily in post and color, like I started color and I wanted to work on indie features. And then I really ended my career in music videos and then eventually commercials, because it was like, all right, so I would regularly book an indie feature that I'd have an hour and a half of footage to color grade in 5 days. And then I'd book a commercial where I'd be getting paid per day what I'd get for the feature per week. And then I'd have like 3 or 4 days to do a 30-second spot. And like the work would be better on that 30-second spot when I had 3 or 4 days to do it. And, you know, it is one of those weird things about Marvel, is that like they should be throwing more people at some of those problems. Like the work would be better and people would be less miserable. You just have to bite the bullet at some point, especially on a show like She-Hulk. When those VFX came out, I was like, there's no one who worked on this who's excited about this. Everyone just made the deadline.
Or when, and like when Ugly Sonic came out and they were, oh, they were all like, LOL, we're just going to redo it. Like the only thing I could think of is like, oh my God, those poor people working on this. Like this is, they just found out via the internet, like they were looking at like BuzzFeed or some shit and were like, found out that they can't go on vacation this year. You know, like, yeah. So sad.
Well, it's also one of those things of, it is hard to, it takes an incredible amount of skill and discipline to give evaluative feedback while it goes. So right. Like, you know, there was an article or a YouTube video or whatever that went around a while ago that was like, guys, there is no other cut of these big famous movies you're hearing about. Like if there was a cut that leaked a month before it came out, like 90% of it would be like animatics and models. Like you're not seeing finished work even a month out. So like if there is someone else's edit out there, it's like, it's not real. It's all like gibberish. And, you know, the same way is like, you know, you're watching the cut. You spend 5 months of your life watching an edit where all of the VFX are like pre-comped or sketches or animatics or something. And then you're really hoping that in those last couple of weeks, it's all going to start to come together. But it could only be like a month before release where you start to get some finished shots in and you're like, nope, this is not a finished shot. This is not what we were expecting this would eventually turn into. And this is why a lot of the bigger VFX heavy directors, you know, James Cameron's whole thing is always, nobody ever walks out of a movie and said, well, at least it shipped on time. And so he would blow every deadline to get the VFX shots right. Which, like, it's weird because you watch Titanic now and the VFX look really dated, but like, at the time, that was a major leap forward because he bankrupted companies because he would never sign a contract where he paid anything before he had shot approval, and he would never approve a shot until he liked it. And he sent at least one VFX company to bankruptcy for that. But like the shots would get better eventually. I'm not saying that that's how to work, but I'm saying it's like why I always tell my students never to build a set, because the problem with building a set is that like all through pre-production, you're like looking at these designs of the set, and you're looking at reference pictures, and you're like, we're all coming together and we're scouting and we're location scouting and we're casting and we're rehearsing. And then it's like 3 days before production and you see the set and it's garbage and you're like, well, shit, fuck, we're stuck with this. Whereas like if you just go location scout and you find a location, you know what it looks like a month out. But like so many times you have this big vision and then it's like 2 days before shooting and the set is garbage and you're like, well, I guess we're shooting on this garbage set. Shit, that sucks.
Oh, no.
So, you know, it's the same thing with VFX where you're like, okay, I guess this is the VFX we have now. So, in celebration of Marcel the Shell getting a theatrical release, wanted to talk about the process of turning shorts into features with Marcel the Shell.
Marcel the Shell.
Has anyone seen it?
I saw it in theaters.
Oh, you did? How was it?
And it was so... I'm so glad this movie exists because, one, I was in the theater with a couple of kids and I was like, you know, this is sweet and entertaining and there's a story and there's a like genuine arc and characters that I'm here with, but it's not information overload. It takes its time to tell the story. And what I, you know, upon thinking about this movie in particular, I was like, there's no way this movie would ever be made if it were not a short that had success on the internet first, because you can't really go to a studio or go to A24 and say, hey, so this is a shell and he talks and he has shoes on and he's about like half an inch high, actually 1 inch high. And that's the movie. And that's our main character. Like nobody would ever take to that. But what I also love about like the origin story of this particular movie is that it was made for Jenny Slate and Dean Fleischman, I think is how you say his name.
Yes.
Thank you. They made it for a sort of like underground comedy show in New York, I believe. And they were just going to screen it for a small audience. And then they did. And then somebody came up after and said, hey, can you put this online so I can share it with my grandma? And that's the only reason it's online. And then, of course, after that, it went viral and people got stick and poke tattoos of it. And apparently an executive was like, we're going to make a movie with Marcel and John Cena. And they're the sort of odd couple fighting crime or something like that. So, but you know, they turned down that offer and decided to make a movie that feels really true to the original shorts that they would make. And it gives me hope. It gives me hope.
Yeah, it's cool. Jenny Slate was on the Smartless podcast. So I kind of heard her talking about all that, which got me really, I somehow missed the short, but I need to go watch it. But I think they funded the whole thing via grants is what she said. And it took them like 7 years to make the feature, which is cool. Like I love hearing stuff like that where they were just like, no, we're going to take our time and make it. And hopefully grants will fund it. We'll just do the whole thing kind of our own way, which, you know, that's an avenue to go that not a lot of people really like just go, hey, well, let's just make it ourselves. We'll just do it with grants. And I mean, I imagine it probably didn't cost a ton to do, especially if it was just, you know, them, Dean Fleischer Camp and whoever else. And I know like Jenny Slate was doing the VO in her closet. Like, so, you know, it all works, which is very, very inspiring. Stuff like that always gets me super stoked. Like the only other like short, like online viral short to movie thing, there's a lot of them with in the horror space, but I just think about David Sandberg with the Lights Out movie. You know, I remember seeing that back in the day and was just like, ooh, that was cool. And then, you know, he's making DC movies and stuff now, which is cool.
Yeah, a long time ago, before it was as commonplace, I had a project that was, I guess, somewhat viral. And it was a short and got a lot of meetings where lots of people were talking up the turning a short from the internet into a feature and what that is. And what I like about this story is the part where you said they have the John Cena version. They're like, no, that's not really what we're thinking. We're thinking this, the spirit of what we did. And I think that takes such willpower and confidence. And you have to have the ability to narrow focus, to think about what you can achieve and actually not fall in love. It's like a siren song. Like when people start talking about big things that could equal big dollars and big opportunities, it's very hard when you're young, or not young age-wise, young industry-wise, mm-hmm. to not be distracted and drawn towards that and just be like, wow, but it's big. Like that's the big ticket. But it's very much an illusion. At least in my experience it was, because that's so much harder to pull off, especially from a budget production standpoint, but also just from a like, why? If all you've done is a short or it's one of the main things, then like why trust all this, you know, power and stuff to somebody, an artist and a creator and a vision that hasn't been tested over 5 minutes or whatever it is. And I think that, you know, my experience was, yeah, it was very easy to be lulled into the like, yeah, yeah, let's spear a big fish. Because also that's what reps want, because more money is more money. It's very attractive. And I think that it's smart to say, can we do a version that's really true to what we did that worked in the first place? Mm-hmm. And can we do a version that we can do actually, that's in our comfort zone of creative? Because you're going out of your comfort zone doing the feature of it anyway when it's a short. This, like, so to me, there's a lot there to learn from or think about for a filmmaker. Like, there's going to be it's not uncommon if you create a short that's good. Like, if you start getting traction, there will be people who will ask you at the festivals for, I'm sure you've all experienced some version of this, you guys, but like, you've created something that some people like, or even at a single festival, and there'll be people who say both, what else do you have? Like, what else are you working on? But they'll also be like, if they like that thing, if that thing is a calling card, there's like, is there another version of this? Is there more of this? You know? So it's stuff to always think about, especially if you're doing the short thing or creating shorter content on YouTube or whatever, to be thinking like, is there another version? Is there a plan here? If people love it so much that I have to try to capitalize on that instead of try to pivot to some entirely different thing. And what is that? How is it something that I can actually do? You know?
And I think that, you know, when you think of the sort of original story that you told or character that you explored in a short, when thinking about what the big picture story is, if you're making the feature version, there's value in also being able to let go of elements. Like, some things may work in the short, but they won't work in a long form version of it. And that takes, I think, discipline as a filmmaker and a storyteller to like let go of the precious thing that you created as well. And that, you know, going through back to Boogie Nights, actually, I don't know if you guys know this, but
That's what I was just thinking about. That's my favorite version of it. Yeah.
The short was a mockumentary, right? And that was sort of, that would not have worked. I don't know, actually, I'm sure PTA would have made it work, a long form mockumentary version of Boogie Nights. But we got to see the seedling of it come through the short. And then we got to see the exploratory phase in the mockumentary short. And then we got Boogie Nights on the other side of it. And we are very lucky.
What do you guys think of the, I always really like the tactic where it's the, you shoot a short that is kind of just a scene from the feature, like the like Damien Chazelle did with Whiplash. Like, there was like that Whiplash short that, I think it was like a Vimeo staff pick or whatever. Like, it kind of blew up for a little while, and I think that was like kind of the thing that like launched his whole deal. I think that's another kind of valid way to approach it. Just kind of like,
I think it is. One thing I want to say on the flip side of this is that, except for that Whiplash example, the vast majority of the shorts and the features that I know about that have been successful, the short was very much designed to stand alone. And I used to have a faculty when I was at SC, one of my professors walked in and said, the first rule of my class is that everything you're making in this class is a complete thing unto itself. I do not want to see the thing that is meant to go viral and get your feature made. I want to see the thing that stands on its own with a beginning, middle, and end. That guy was great. That was Elliot Silverstein. I love that guy. And like, I also think, like, you know, I would say 80% of the filmmakers I know have tried to have made shorts hoping that it would break out and help them get a feature made. And none of them have. And like, the feature I made, we didn't do a short first. We just went and did a feature. And I think that, like, you have to be really careful of, like, if you're going to do it, make sure the short itself, like Marcel Desailles, they just made a short that they thought was great and someone wanted to show their grandma. Like, make the short on its own an interesting, compelling, complete thing that is like engaging within itself, and you're in much better shape. And I think that that's like the interesting thing to take away, because like, I've also seen a whole bunch of shorts that are like gibberish. And when I talk to the filmmaker about feedback or whatever, and they're like, yeah, but this is just like the opening scene of a feature. And I'm like, well, yeah, but you haven't convinced me I want to see a feature with this opening scene.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you haven't actually sold me on why I would want to spend 90 minutes in this world, and I don't understand what's going on. And they're like, yeah, but the feature will explain it. And I'm like, no, but that's not how it works. Like this, the short has to be something people are like, ooh, I loved that. Can I see more of that, please?
Yeah.
And
I mean, I think that Todd is, I think you're right. And it's just good practice to make a thing that stands on its own and be good at that.
But I mean, it's doable. Like clearly Damien Chazelle had the Whiplash feature. Like I think if you
right, put effort I would say into the
it,
counter,
you can do it. Like I think it's
yeah, the achievable. Counterpoint is like you're making it for the express purpose of I'm going to sell the big idea with this.
Yeah,
like
I could totally
that's
see.
That's a whole different thing.
I could have totally just as easy seen that not even make the cut of the film. It does, it's that is a, like, it has a beginning, middle, and end to that scene or whatever. So
exactly.
It kind of fills both things. But I do see what you're saying. Like, I do, like, when you watch a short film and it's like some crazy world building thing where there's like all these sort of like, really small details that you're like, okay, so clearly they probably wrote like five episodes of some fantasy show that they're trying to get done. And I'm supposed to, like, and therefore the short itself isn't as strong because there's a bunch of, you know, exposition that you don't have and you don't know what these things are, which I've seen a ton, where it's like, okay, I don't know why the, like, why is that thing glowing like that? Okay, whatever. So yeah, I mean, I see both sides for sure.
I could also, yeah. I've seen shorts that actually tell a complete story, but leave a cliffhanger that works.
Yeah.
And that's like starting a conversation, but it's still a story, a scene or whatever format it is with a beginning, middle, and end. And I also feel like fatigued by shorts or projects that haven't done the work because it feels like it's like pushing off the work that will need to be done anyway. And then I don't have as much confidence in the person as a filmmaker if they can't tell a story with a beginning, middle, and end. Even if it's like a 1 minute short. Like there was this great thing. It was a Vimeo pick of the week. And it was called The Reveal. And it was about a boyfriend, girlfriend, and the guy has a beard and she looks over to him and she's like, I've never seen your face. And so he shaves his beard and then she ends up leaving him. 1 minute. Beginning, middle, end, two characters. It's so funny. And I spoiled it. But like, I was like, yes, they did the work to figure it out.
No, you didn't spoil it. Any man with a beard knows if we shaved the beard, our women would leave us. Like, we just know it. You don't need to spoil. We're aware.
I'm sure there's that a feature man was a there. Fool. Sure, there's a feature there.
Yes. Yeah.
Quick little tech news. So, Arri, if you don't know Arri, they make cameras. They make the Alexa. It's everyone's favorite. They make lights, including the Orbiter and the Sky Panels. Everyone's also favorites. And they have just launched a new lighting OS because we're now in a place in filmmaker history where we have lighting OS. Like, your light has an operating system that you can upgrade. Like, it, you know, for the last 10 years, whatever, our lights have had menus. And every once in a while, you have to do like a firmware upgrade where you're like, oh, I want to unlock some new feature. I'll do the firmware upgrade on my light. I'll figure out how to do it. I'll like find a weird micro SD adapter to make it happen. But now Arri is like, yep, we're going to call it Lighting OS. You're going to regularly update it like a normal OS. And their new Lighting OS does something that is cool as shit, which is you can design it. Like, you know, previously the Lighting OS, you can control it from like your iPad or you can control it from like a DMX board. You can control it from like the light unit. But they're now adding control triggers so that the camera made by Arri can trigger the light. Oh. And there's been some stuff for like workarounds with like Arduino boards to do this before. You can get an Arduino controller for Blackmagic that can trigger lights. But like, this is the first time it's just like natively built in that I'm aware of where like you're doing stuff to the camera can trigger lighting changes. And why is this cool as shit? Well, like, you know, there's lots of times where you want to change your exposure. Like, let's say I'm doing a speed ramp. Where like, you know, the actors are moving normal speed and then I want to ramp down to slow-mo because action scene or whatever. Usually you have to do that with an aperture change. You change the aperture, you're changing your depth of field. With this, you can do the speed ramping camera and then the camera can change the lighting so that the lighting changes, your exposure stays the same and your aperture doesn't change. And that is cool as shit.
So I'm not entirely clear. So are you saying that the camera has like a button? Or are you saying that you can set up your lighting to respond to the, let's say the histogram and it'll change because of the histogram? Is that what you're saying?
So you can set triggers in your camera settings. And those triggers will then trigger things in the lights. So the camera already, their lights are already getting pretty sophisticated. Like the Orbiter has built in light and color sensors on top. So you can set it to be like, oh, I'm outside on a cloudy day and a cloud blows in front of the sun. The Orbiter will respond to that by like changing its color temperature and its intensity so that your exposure stays on. So like the Orbiter will already do stuff like that. But this is more that you can program it so that certain triggers in the camera trigger things in the light. So like when you hit the speed ramp button in your camera, you can trigger that to change the speed at which the camera is shooting and also lighting effects triggered by the camera change.
Okay, I got it. You essentially, could you like have like a lightning trigger on your camera essentially?
Yes, you could totally do that. You could assign one of your buttons so that the camera operator can trigger lightning.
That's sick. Okay, cool.
Yeah, it's like,
is that only in the Orbiter line, or are they working that into the
Sky should panel? Roll out for Sky panel as well.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah,
I could see that. So that's really good for wonners and stuff, and you know, everyone loves a good wonner, but those are notoriously, like you said, like, so if let's say you're starting outside and you got to come inside, but do you want the indoors to be lit right while you're outside as well? Yeah, there's a lot of stuff you could do with that. That's really cool.
Well, and it actually hadn't occurred to me, but yeah, I mean, one of the things we're constantly doing as filmmakers is like one thing is supposed to trigger another. And if you watch old movies, you can see it being done by hand. So like you'll watch a character like turn on a lamp and then you'll see the lighting come on around the lamp like a second later as some poor bestie is standing over at the lighting board, like watching it happen. Whereas with this, it's sort of automatically triggered. So you turn on the lamp, the light turns on. We've had that for a while with the MX, but this is then camera stuff can trigger it. So yeah, I mean, what you're saying of like, as you walk from inside to outside, you know, you could set up a motion trap for the camera, but you could also set up for like, oh, as you rack closer, that's going to trigger this lighting change as well. So like you move into a close-up and you want the lighting to change as you move into a close-up. Well, you can set it so that it's triggered by changes in the focus knob, which is controlled by the ARRI camera. So it's not one of those things of like, all right, you're watching it move into a close-up and you're like rocking the panel. Like automatically, as the focus moves closer, the lighting changes.
That's so cool. I feel like I've had many a DP friend patiently explain why we can't do that because, you know, working on indie projects. And maybe soon I'll be able to be like, but now look.
You just get out your phone.
Well, I mean, the thing to know is that, you know, ARRI is the top of the line stuff. So like it is rare, you know, I'm trying to think of the last job I was on that was all ARRI, that was like AirFlex cameras and all ARRI lighting. Even when I'm on Alexa jobs, there's still a lot of non-ARRI branded lighting around. It's only the biggest jobs I get to do where it's all like Sky panels. Yeah, and
probably,
I still haven't done
probably lots of Aputure, right? Lots of Sidus Link.
Yeah, there's a lot of Aputure stuff. The Aputure 1200 is like a great light and it's so affordable and it's so flexible. So especially if I'm on batteries, there's always going to be a lot of Aputure. If I'm on tubes, I really like the Godox tubes lately because I like the remote. Yeah, I mean that even on Alexa jobs, I end up lighting with like, Sky panels are expensive. They're great. They're wonderful lights. I love them when we have the budget, but like I don't always have the budget to bring out a bunch of Sky panels. I feel like there's like light panels come out quite a bit. I feel like the Titans come out sometimes, but Sky panels, but I don't think I've ever done a 100% Sky panel job. Probably not, just because it's expensive. Have you shot with the Orbiter yet? I haven't shot with the Orbiter.
No, yet. I haven't even seen one on set yet.
Yeah, they're expensive.
Yeah. No, I'm fully in Aputure land where around here it's mostly, I mean, unless you're on like the big jobs, even those are just, you know, HMIs, like there's not a lot of
M18s.
Yeah, there's not a lot of Orbiters going on.
The thing that will be exciting is when Aputure teams up with a camera company to bring this kind of triggering that's like open source. It's like
I was going to say at some point, kind of triggering. Doesn't the existence of it mean it's possible that it'll start to cross over into other places too?
Well, there are times where Aputure and Godox come out with stuff first. Like there are some features that I was like, oh, okay, you guys are ahead of this. And the fact that anybody has it means it will eventually come to everybody. The trick here is that ARRI makes the lights and ARRI makes the cameras. And this is actually kind of a sophisticated integration. Like, to be honest, I've had some issues with the ARRI Stellar app. I've only used it a few times and it's been really hiccupy to me. Like, I don't depend on it. If I'm on SkyPanels, I'm on a DMX board, because the Stellar app, like, I had some real issues with it on a demo once. I was like giving a lecture and we were at a rental house and we couldn't get any of the units at the rental house to work. We tried like 3 Stellar units and we couldn't. It was a real like, well, let's do DMX moment. So like, I'm wary as to how well this is going to work in the field, but it's Airy and they're putting their name behind it. So I think it will work. But like, the idea, like, unless Aperture sits down with Blackmagic and gets Blackmagic to build the hardware into the cameras, which is possible. So I hope Aperture sits down with Blackmagic. Aperture, Blackmagic, I can introduce you guys. I bet you know each other already. I think it'll be, it's hard for me to picture what this would look like if you don't also make the camera. Like, would it plug into the, would it be like a box you could plug into the accessory port of a camera?
Yeah.
Is that what, like, it would have to be?
Yeah, something like that. Like the, yeah, just like the remote. Like a remote kind of situation.
Yeah. This is one of those things that'll be a long time before competitors come, I think.
This is like a coming from the least techie person on the podcast question. Would it be valuable to have like all this sort of integration activated through like voice, like how your Google Home, you can like say, turn on my lights and then the Philips will light. Like, do you think we're moving in that direction, or is it all going to be like automated and connected through like navigating through tiny screens, et cetera, in the future?
Well, the problem with voice is unless you're doing a commercial, sound is always a distraction, right? Like, even if it's a commercial with dialogue or a narrative project or a music video, sound is never going to be the move. Also, like, I only use one voice control, which is Sonos, because it's the only one that's private. Like, it's all local. And maybe it's not as good as the others because it's all local, but like a full third of my commands, Sonos is like, you want me to play what? And I'm like, jazz, Sonos. I want you to play jazz.
I think in terms of what Gigi's asking though, like, it could be really cool to like, say you're on set and you're like, hey, Orbiter 3, come down, you know, 200 foot candles or something, like, and it like goes, you know, like that would be pretty sick. I mean,
it would also be nice if actors' lines could trigger it. Like, if we could get Sonos to be like, when Thor says, I am Super Thor, which is a line that shows up in all of his movies, right? Some sort of lighting thing was automatically triggered by Thor saying, Super Thor powers go. Mm-hmm. Or when Morb is like, it's Morbin time, and then the lights Morb it up.
Man, the Thor movies would be so much more interesting to me if there were things like that. Like you said, Super Thor time go and lights flashed. That's all I'm looking for, man.
Take notes, Taika.
I have notes for every super, super successful person in the industry this week.
All right. I'm Charles Hayne. I'm on the internet at Charles Hayne. I got YouTube videos coming out about this short film I just made on 8-hour days and lessons learned and shooting with bikes. And I'm on Twitter, but it's all bike shit.
We love bikes, though. I'm Gigi Hawkins. You can find me on the internet at Lost in Graceland, named after two grandmas. And I think this comes out on Thursday. And we love both grandmas. This comes out on Thursday. And I'm teaming up with a couple of folks for a post-row comedy fundraiser and challenge. And we'll be posting about that on our social media as well. So keep an eye out for that.
Nice. I'm Todd Blankenship. You can find me on YouTube at Am I a Filmmaker. Just dropped a new video on there launching this short film project I did out in the desert with a film camera and a CG robot and all kind of fun stuff coming on there soon.
That sounds cool. And I'm George Edelman, Editor-in-Chief at No Film School. And you can find out about a lot of the things we talked about today and more, of course, at nofilmschool.com. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, check us out on Instagram, check out our YouTube. Every once in a while, Todd and Charles do stuff. And other people do stuff there too, and it's cool. Thanks so much for listening. And be sure to leave a comment, like, rate, subscribe. Send us questions at editor@nofilmschool.com.